supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Police officers spent the day negotiating with an armed man in a Panera Bread restaurant near Princeton University, and according to the New Jersey Attorney General's office, that man is dead. WHYY's Dana DeFilippo was on hand as the situation unfolded today and joins us live on the line from just outside police barricades on Nassau Street. A long day, Dana. What's known at this hour?
Hi, Dave. This whole incident started about 10:30 this morning. A gunman burst into the Panera Bread or the Panera Cafe right across the street from the university. And there was a couple customers inside, and they were terrified. They were able to escape out the back. So police arrived pretty quickly and surrounded the building. They evacuated everyone from all the surrounding businesses. They had schools in the town shelter in place. They evacuated a couple campus buildings. Campus is actually on spring break right now. Princeton is on spring break. So there's about 8,000 students that are normally there that aren't here this week. So that was good news for this incident. They sent in negotiators to try to get him to peacefully surrender. He did not do that. And just before 3 o'clock, they did report that the gunman died. Police are describing that as a police-involved death, a police-involved shooting. And so what basically happens next is the Attorney General's office, they review all incidents of deadly police force. And if they decide for whatever reason that there was anything that was not justified, if it wasn't a justified use of force, then they'll present the case to a grand jury. But as of right now, there's still a lot that we don't know. We don't know who it is. They have to notify the next of kin in this case. We don't know what, why he did what he did. And we don't really know much about him. Some police on the scene are saying that it was a veteran who was distraught. But at this point, we don't really have many more details on him than that.
Thanks, Dana.
Sure, thank you.
WHYY's Dana DeFilippo reporting on the scene on Nassau Street, just outside the space where a man was shot by New Jersey police this afternoon. That is an ongoing investigation. The weather. Well, the winter storm warning is in effect, and it extends until 2 a.m. Thursday. So for tonight, a mess. Rain, snow, sleet, freezing rain, windy as well, low around 30 degrees. That all changes over tomorrow early in the morning to snow. Snow extending well into the evening, heavy at times. We could even hear a rumble of thunder. Wind gust to 33 miles an hour, and when it's all said and done, we're looking at a potential for 9 to 16 inches of snow in Philadelphia. That gives way to sunny days, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, high each day around 44. Meanwhile, SEPTA General Manager Jeff Knuppel says they'll do all they can to keep as many lines running as possible through the latest nor'easter.
On regional rail, we'll operate on a severe storm schedule. That's very, very important. This is not the normal schedule on the railroad tomorrow. This is a Saturday schedule for most lines. However, we will enhance service on the Wilmington-Newark line to provide service to Newark and Churchman's Crossing.
Officials say the Broad Street and Market Frankfort lines are the best bet for commuters. More info at SEPTA.org. PATCO will begin running a snow schedule starting at midnight tonight. All trains will be local and will operate at reduced speeds. A detailed snow schedule is available at RidePATCO.org. And the Pennsylvania Turnpike has announced a ban on vehicles due to the storm. Officials say vehicles being banned as of 8 this evening are empty straight CDL-weighted trucks, double trailers, tractors hauling empty trailers, and any trailers pulled by motorcycles, passenger vehicles, pickup trucks, or sport utility vehicles. Motorcycles and recreational vehicles are also banned as of 8 this evening. Turnpike officials say a comprehensive commercial vehicle ban or speed restrictions could be imposed as storm conditions develop. In other news today was the deadline for candidates to file petitions to run in Pennsylvania's shape-shifting congressional districts. The state Supreme Court redrew all the state's congressional boundaries, and it wasn't until yesterday that it was certain that those district lines would hold as federal courts rejected Republican efforts to overturn the boundaries and return to the old districts. To sort out what's ahead in the race here across the Philadelphia region, we turn to WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. And Dave, first off, you want to briefly remind us how we got here?
It's been an extraordinary series of events, Dave. You know, there was this lawsuit challenging the districts as a Republican gerrymander. The state Supreme Court agreed they were and also agreed with the plaintiffs here that the districts could be redrawn with astonishing speed to apply to this year's congressional races. The Republicans objected. They went to court. There was a fight. But here we are with pretty radically redrawn congressional districts and candidates ahead to scramble, figuring out where they want to run.
We'll focus on the candidates, but first, how does the new map change the political balance in these local races?
Well, pretty dramatically, I think. You know, before, there were three solidly Democratic seats that were part Philadelphia, part suburban. Now what we have are six district seats, which are pretty much centered around counties, two in the Philadelphia County and then one in each of the four suburban counties, one for Bucks, one for Montgomery, one for Delaware, and one for Chester counties. And when political pros look at how these areas might vote, what they have found, if you check, for example, the Larissa Sabato's Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, he says that four of those six local seats are safe Democratic seats, the two Philadelphia seats and the Delaware County and Montgomery seats. The remaining two are considered toss-ups this fall. So that could be a big swing toward the Democrats.
Well, that being said, were there surprises among candidates that filed?
A few. One thing was just the number of them. 35 candidates filed today for these six seats. In Montgomery County, we saw the reemergence of Joe Huffel, who had represented that district years ago in Congress. He will be there facing three formidable Democratic women in the primary, two state representatives, Madeline Dean and Mary Jo Daly, and Shira Goodman, who represented the anti-gun group, Ceasefire PA. In Bucks County, Republican incumbent Brian Fitzpatrick is going to have a primary challenger, a Trump supporter named Dean Malik. So there will be some battles everywhere.
Montgomery, Bucks. What about that Delaware County district looking wide open since Congressman Pat Meehan bowed out of the race after admitting he settled a sexual harassment complaint?
Yeah, it's a rumble there on the Democratic side, Dave. 14 Democrats filed for that race. Two state representatives, Margaret Davidson and Greg Vitale, the mayor of Chester, Thaddeus Kirkland, Dan Muroff, who's run for Congress before, and a whole crop of hard-charging women, mostly first-time candidates inspired by the election of Trump, Molly Sheehan, Shelley Chauncey, Ashley Lunkenheimer, Mary Gay Scanlon, Lindy Lee, and a guy named George Beatty, a former mummer who's run before. But the interesting thing here, Dave, we have all these Delaware County candidates, but there's going to be a Philadelphia versus Delaware County dynamic because Rich Laser from South Philadelphia, the sole candidate from the relatively small Philadelphia part of the district, is in, and he will have a lot of support from trade unions and will get an independent expenditure campaign from a super PAC that could be very powerful. I've spoken to the Delaware County chairman of the Democratic Party, David Landau. He's concerned about this. He wants to have a process and see if they can unite around a single Delaware County candidate.
So we have some three dozen candidates. What happens next?
Well, next, challenges will be filed to knock out candidates by challenging the signatures on their nominating petitions. This is a regular thing that happens all the time. So it could be some of these challengers will get knocked away. The field could be thinned a bit. And then the primary is May 15th, just 8 weeks away.
Springtime.
Yep.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies on Newsworks Tonight. Some commutes are better than others, but some are literally the worst, even when the weather is clear. SEPTA's Route 9 bus is one of the latter. It's late more often than any other route in SEPTA's system. Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly hopped on the 9 recently to talk to riders and try to figure out why it's never on time.
Out of SEPTA's 184 different bus routes and train lines, Route 9 is the worst. In on-time performance, that is.
It's horrible. Especially when it's miserable out.
That's Cindy Payne, who commutes to Roxborough Memorial Hospital by taking the 32 and then transferring to the 9. Payne often finds herself waiting in the cold and rain for her regularly irregular bus to arrive.
It could be 5 minutes, 10 minutes, sometimes like a half hour. It varies. Even if the schedule says one time, I'll still be waiting out there past, you know, the set schedule.
SEPTA has a pretty loose definition of what is and isn't on time. Like all transit agencies, SEPTA considers a vehicle on time if it's less than 2 minutes early or up to 6 minutes late. If it shows up 5 minutes late, it'll feel pretty tardy to the average strap hanger, but that's perfectly punctual for SEPTA's stack keeping. Even under that lax standard, the 9 bus only manages a 60% on time average. So, why is the 9 so bad? Unlike the route itself, the answer is pretty straightforward. First, it's relatively long, 12 miles. The route starts up in Roxborough, winding its way down Ridge Avenue. And then it gets on the always stop-and-go Schuylkill Expressway. After that, the 9 fights its way down Chestnut Street to Old City. Those three roadways have one big thing in common.
A lot of traffic.
That's Charles Webb, SEPTA's chief service planner.
I mean, on a regular basis, a lot of traffic, especially in rush hours, and, you know, that we're competing with and we're part of.
And if you've ever taken the Schuylkill Expressway, you know that jams there are somehow both incessant and unexpected. Call it Schrodinger's cars or Murphy's traffic law, but trying to plan for congestion on I-76 is nearly impossible, says SEPTA's chief for surface transportation, Mike Liberi.
So our on-time performance, while admittedly weak, is really a component of its routing. And the Schuylkill Expressway plays a large part in that lateness.
Thing is, though, there isn't much SEPTA can do about it. The alternative routes that would avoid I-76 or Ridge Avenue would be even worse. And Route 9's spotty service is still relatively frequent. Sure, a specific bus may not show up when it's scheduled, but they run every 10 to 12 minutes during rush hour. Missing one bus isn't a day ruiner, except on the weekends when the buses only come once or twice an hour. Gloria Fields uses the Route 9 to get downtown from her home in Manioc.
The 9 on Saturdays is horrible, horrible. During the week, working hours is fine, but non-working hours on Saturdays and Sundays, it's terrible.
So it might not be all that reliable, and it's slow on the weekends, but back on the bus, lots of riders say they still like the Route 9. And some, like Camille D'Attilio, really like it.
Actually, I love the 9.
Okay.
Yeah, during the storms, I understand why it doesn't go up Ridge Avenue for the safety of people, and I wish that there was some way that the 9 could, but I love this bus. I always get excited to take the 9 bus.
D'Attilio lives in Roxborough and works at a salon in Center City. The Route 9 takes her exactly where she needs to go. If it's late, she simply runs an errand. D'Attilio says she prefers taking public transportation over driving. Taking the bus gives her something being alone in a car doesn't.
You know, I think that being a part of the community of Philadelphia, I think that you really get to know who your people are. And then you realize that there are really good people in Philadelphia by taking the bus. And I didn't get to experience that when I drove a car.
So yeah, waiting for the bus can suck. But that can also be a time for commiseration with your fellow travelers. Time to maybe even make a friend. While SEPTA can sometimes run absurdly late, getting on the bus can remind us that we're all in this together. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
Are New Jersey Republicans really doomed now that Governor Chris Christie is gone and Phil Murphy's in? Reporter Brent Johnson proffered that possibility and then offered analysis of the Garden State Grand Old Party going forward in an article in NJ.com. Brent, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
First, let's do the numbers. What is representation in Trenton?
Well, it's at for Republicans, it's the lowest since 1979. They have 41 members of the state legislature, and there are 120 seats. So not exactly high.
So to what extent does this have to do with Governor Chris Christie?
Well, there's a big debate about this, about what Christie did to help or hurt the party. He and his advisors will say that he came in and spent lots of money to help promote the party, and that he himself became a brand that helped bring attention to the Republican Party. Because for the last 8 years, really, the center of the Republican Party and the focus was Chris Christie. Then there are those who will tell you that he had to cut his deals with Democrats who control the legislature, so that kind of marginalized Republicans, and that he didn't really leave a very deep bench, that there wasn't someone to really take over for him and run with it.
Now, that may be the analysis of pundits, but what do Senate Minority Leader Tom Kaine and Assembly Minority Leader John Bramnick make of the situation now?
Well, they will first tell you that there's a legislative map that was drawn in 2010, 2011 that gives Democrats the advantage, and that's why they're still in control. But they will also say that we now have a governor, Governor Phil Murphy, who is about to raise taxes in his first state budget, and they're saying, hey, we are unified. Democrats don't really know whether they're going to be on board with these taxes, these tax hikes, and we're going to fight against them. We're going to be the voice against rising costs in New Jersey. So they're saying they're going to be a unified front. Whether that works and will lead to more seats in the legislature is the question.
Now, Bramnick, for one, was a longtime ally of Christie, who is a longtime friend of Donald Trump. And when we bring Trump into the mix, does that push more New Jersey residents toward the Democratic fold?
Well, that's one question. Trump is incredibly unpopular in New Jersey, that his poll numbers here are among the lowest that they are in any state in the nation. And you're starting to see Republicans sort of distance themselves from Trump. One of them is Bramnick, who has been very vocally in the past few weeks saying, we need to speak to the center of the aisle. We need to talk to the moderates, because that's where most people in New Jersey are. When it comes to political ideology, most people are moderate, he says, so we have to reach out to them. So you're starting, he doesn't name Trump by name per se, but he has called out Trump's Twitter account and said that, you know, we can't be governing by a series of nasty tweets. But no one's willing to call out Trump by name, but they are starting to distance themselves from what they see his stances and his ideology.
Is it your assessment that Democratic lawmakers are content, if not smug, or would they be open to entreaties to reach across the aisle?
I think Democrats would be. You see State Senate President Steve Sweeney, who is the leading lawmaker in the state, a Democrat. He has waged this new opposition against raising taxes. Murphy wants to raise taxes, wants to raise the sales tax. He wants to raise taxes on millionaires. And Sweeney's shown some opposition to that, saying, hey, you know, a lot's going on in Washington. We just had that federal tax reform that hurt New Jersey. Let's think twice and before we raise taxes and focus on cutting spending, too. And you see the state assembly speaker, Craig Coughlin, also a Democrat, fall in line with that as well. So I think reaching out to the middle is something you're going to see a lot of lawmakers do. It's just a new age.
Lastly, let's come full circle, Brent. Is it your assessment, having done this analysis, that New Jersey Republicans are doomed in the Phil Murphy era?
No, I don't think doomed is the right word. I mean, some people would say it'll be a lot harder now to be a Republican. And, you know, the history does show that Republicans do tend to have a better record against incumbent Democrats when they run for reelection. It'll be tough. It's going to be a really tough road the next few years for the Republican Party, but I don't think all is lost.
Thanks, Brent.
Thank you for having me. It was great to be here.
Brent Johnson, NJ.com reporter on NewsWorks Tonight. Next month, LaSalle University will auction off some of the most valuable paintings in its collection. While the school hopes to raise between $5 and $7 million to help fund educational programs, WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the plan is getting some pushback from students, faculty, and alumni.
About 15 students stood in a snowstorm outside the campus library to protest the planned auction of 46 artworks. One organizer of a group called the Friends of LaSalle Art Museum is Paul Fitzpatrick, who says the art collection is an educational component of the campus.
Brother Daniel Burke, who was one of the former presidents and really built this collection, did it as an encyclopedic collection to teach people about art, to be open to the community. You know, this is our Heritage Week this week. If we're not really walking the talk, if we're not protecting something that was given to us in good faith, how is that good?
Since the art sale was announced over the winter break, the student group has been rallying support to convince university administrators to retain the artwork. A few weeks ago, it presented the university's president, Colleen Hanich, and its board of trustees a letter signed by 300 LaSalle alumni urging them to reconsider. The Faculty Senate also sent a letter of its own opposing the sale. In a written response, the president and board chair say they are running a whole university, not just its museum, and that recent financial challenges, quote, present difficult choices and decisions to ensure our students and university are successful. From a legal perspective, the university can use its art collection as a financial asset if it wishes, unless those who donated the art to LaSalle restricted how it could be displayed, loaned, or sold. The state attorney general is currently reviewing the auction to see if there are any legal questions. The paintings are scheduled to be part of auctions at Christie's New York on April 18th and 19th. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.